And Dr. Sawyer's request the questions today, so I'm here.
Yes.
I was wondering if Rebbe could reflect on the current events over the past few months and more recent regarding the financial crisis in the world and more recent what will look like, really lessons we can glean from these events.
I'm not sure you may reflect upon. Reflections can be of various kinds. Some things you reflect upon certain matters with which you totally disagree or are upset about. Probably the most famous book which had reflections in its title is Burke's Reflections of the Revolution in France. Burke was vehemently opposed to the French Revolution, everything it stood for. But you can reflect upon. There's also a certain element of reflections which suggests, and this is what I like about the word, I use it occasionally in titles of things also, it enables you to speak, maintain a certain distance from the phenomenon, from a certain philosophic vantage point, as it were, and also, at the same time, to, in a different vein, a different kind of reflections, to be something which is very visceral, existential. I mentioned Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France. If you read C.S. Lewis' book, Reflections on the Psalms, a very interesting book. There you can see someone who's reflecting, but in a much more visceral sense. I mentioned though, in relation to your question with relation to the economy, that I would imagine could call for one or two different answers. What are some thoughts on how things are going, and why they're going, and where they're going, with the possible response one would give ranging from a very theological way of looking at it, why the Hashgach is putting the world through this. Why this is happening, that's happening. So the people who are much more in sync with Hashgacha than I am. The other can be a reflection, simply you want to play, you know, not to interpret the why's and the where, why things are happening, but how one responds to them, how one perceives them, how one views them. Some things don't require much reflection in terms of attitudinally, this Madoff business, which alluded, is certainly from every standpoint, morally speaking, a disaster. So much to reflect upon. I think, unless one wants to get involved, there's some theological speculation as to why this is happening and what it says about, maybe theological, also sociological, what it says about the American system. Economy, American society, the political, economic fabric and fiber. The other things which work up a lot of moral passion in some people, and other people think it makes a great deal of sense. Globalization, I think, is one of those things. Unlike the Madoff scam, globalization has certain major advantages, major disadvantages. Part of the difficulties that are attendant upon it, and which some people are very much upset about, and correctly so, that it enables powerful, politically powerful, economically powerful, to exploit aspects of the globalization in order to increase their mastery, their control of the world economy. Detriment of many people who are laboring in, not sweatshops, it's worse than sweatshops. Sweatshop, otherwise it would be the sweatshop. And advantage is being taken of them. And so what happens in, if you look at a globalized economy, so you more or less get raw materials, produce, sell within the same ambience, the same ballpark. So you, there's some reasonable proportion between what you pay for the raw materials, what you earn for producing a finished product, and what you sell. Globalization enables you to buy the raw materials where they're cheapest, then to move the raw materials to another country where labor is cheapest, and then to sell it in the country where products, the products that you're selling are the most expensive. And this hopping around, which not everyone can manage. Big international firms can jump around this way. They can have, they can buy fibers in Africa and manufacture in China and Poland, suits or whatever it may be. If you're a small company, you can't afford to do that. Therefore, the multinationals have a big, big advantage. See, if they were all very altruistically motivated, be fine. Part of the advantages of mercantilism was particularly that direction. But number one, they're not altruistically motivated. And number two, they will even explain to you why it's also for them to be altruistic. Because you think that they owe a debt to people who are sweating in Malaysia or Zimbabwe for peanuts. They say, no, their first responsibility is not to those people. Their first responsibility is to the stockholders. They're Shluch of the Rachman, Shluch of the Dan. And they will explain to you why they can't give much stock here, because they owe to the stockholders. If you're a shliach, you can't give tzedakah, you have to work for your mishaleach. And that, of course, puts many kinds of disadvantage. It makes it easier to manipulate prices. The commodities market the last half year or so have been absolutely crazy. First, the price all shot up. You read the newspapers, the world economy is going broke because commodities are so expensive. And then, in a relatively short period of time, the most dramatic case is that of oil, which went from $147 at the barrel to 45, or wherever it's now. But it seemed to happen to many others, and countries which are very dependent upon the commodities, the raw materials, taking a terrific beating, which they can't cope with that. But there, as I've said, if companies were less greedy, there could be real advantages to it in producing goods which could be for consumers at a more reasonable price than they would sell otherwise. If we talk about what happens in securities markets, that I imagine depends where people are. The people who are owning securities are upset, and particularly upset because they don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. They did. The World Bank just said, gave some forecast last week, 2009, the developing countries, would have better growth rate than developed countries. 2010, then you get back to normal and there'd be a better growth rate, etc. People, either as individuals or those who are involved with the corporate world or the institutional world, if they knew they just had to sweat through a year and a half, they'd tighten their belts and manage. But if someone comes along and tells you this is a crisis which happens once in a century, or they don't know how it'll end and when it'll end, Uncertainty is very, very difficult. Does any of this make for more emunah, less emunah, for more bitachon, less bitachon? It all starts with, depends on how much bitachon and emunah you start with. People who have generally sense of emunah and bitachon, there are two things. First of all, they have two contradictory feelings, each of which can be understood religiously speaking, but the balance between the two is not easy to define. I'm just thinking something else, last week's parsha. The word emunah bitachon, milon gadol v'ramban. Ramban was, whether he wrote that treatise that emunah bitachon, which appears in Chevel's collection, is problematic. Shlomo Sofer's introduction, which I think reasonably explains why that should not be included in the volume. But leaving aside that tractate, that treatise, the Ramban talks about why Avraham Avinu was punished, Klal Yisrael was punished, Shimon and Mitzrayim. Against all of the opinions, the Gemara Nedarim, which has a list of such days, as Sagadu Zechachomim, or Ramban said, no, because during the time of crisis, instead of staying in Eretz Yisrael, he went to Mitzrayim. And this is where the Pasuk said, Yirah Baretz. And of course, the passage in Ramban Bechukesai regarding before that people should go to doctors when if they're not in the high spiritual material, it was raised, wouldn't go there. That same Ramban says that his wife's Yaakov, it's a low because you can't be sick. Even if you have explicit promise for the Bishlam, you can't be similar to Tzitzkis. And if you can't have just a Munah Mitoch. The people who have it, they are, I don't want to say torn, but they're divided by two contradictory reflections of feelings. One is that everything will be okay. Life of the Benishleir, the many psukim which speak in that vein, etc., just rely on the Benishleir. The other, which some people feel to be a more religious one, is the sense that I don't know whether things will be good or not. But regardless of whether they'll be good or not, I'm with the Benishleir. Luig Teledi Lo Yachil, which is what he has said. Some years back, before he came here, Bach Motel Lil, the Igris Munabitachim Chazelish, which I find to be very powerful, very powerful. The point that he makes, more than a very central, the central point that he makes this connection, he says people are wrong. They think that Bitachim means that things are going to go well. And I'm sure the Bishop is on my side. So who says it's on your side? Maybe it's not on your side, maybe it's on your opponent's side. But to have Munah Bitachon is to rely upon the Rishlim, no matter what happens, you're with him. After Mechavet Yom Kippurim, I was asked at one point to speak to some group of Ksinim by the Masada Bitachon on the theme of Bitachon. Not about their Bitachon, but and I spoke in this vein as well. During the course of writing that piece, that I came across Chassidish, which is on the same spirit. I think that the thesis which he pushes, which is, he presents also a historical fact, that no one ever understood Yisrael over the top of it, that vein. That I think is factually an error. Abu Rabbi Mechayez, Kadakevach, look at the entry of Bitochen, and it's all in the same spirit, that things are going to be, go well, the life of the Beishleilam, be in good shape. But if you're not ask yourself what people thought factually, what one ought to think, I think the Chazon Ish is certainly correct. But for most people, some combination of the two, relying on it and placing your trust in the Ben Shleilim, it will help you out, it will bail you out, it will save you. And at the same time, seeing to it that your Avos Hashem is Avos Shetlui B'Dovo, not even totally will Ben Shleilim rescue you or not. Shetlui B'Dovo, that's the Vahav Tashem Al-Kech, that's what Avos Hashem is all about. So I guess it's in terms of the relation that people reflect upon and respond to the financial crisis, it's probably a blend of these two, in the sense that batten down the hatches to wait till the wind tide blows over, and in a couple of years you'll be back on your feet. As opposed to the other sense, that whoever gave you a contract that you have to be wealthy, you could be poor, you could be middle class. But none of this includes reflections upon the economic roots, which do entail some thought. A moral vein. Much has been written about the fact that the privations of stock markets have to do with some AC, some alternating current between greed and fear. And some of the balance which exists, when people are more greedier, they're optimistic. And the greed feeds upon itself. The fear is understandable. When it's going down, you don't know how quickly where it's going to stop, if it's going to go down, and then people are looking to get out. You might understand what you ask, that you feel that the events of the past year or so, let us say, which is well, how some people date the recession in the States, is a unique chapter of the social conversation of the West. Calls for special reflections. One primary lesson is to be Samech Bechelke. But that poses for many of us a problem in its own right. I mentioned more than one occasion the Ramban, Chayesorah, when he mentions Avraham ben Zakir Svayomim. So he says this is that he saw as much of life as he wanted to see, all his ambitions, all his aspirations fulfilled in his own life. He doesn't get involved with what the Gemara in Baba Basra says. Baba Basra says that despite some problems with his own family, but Yishmael was Chayzer B'Tshuva before he died. Esau was not Yitzhak Tabuschor before he died. So he only saw the best of his family. That the Ramban doesn't get involved in, but he says simply that this is the way of tzaddikim. Of course, it's possible that the David HaMelech as well, tzaddikim, they don't have great aspirations. They can be satisfied with relatively less, and be satisfied with what they have. They even are not questing for longer life. this runs so totally counter to the modern spirit, to the Faustian instinct, which is so strong in us, and which we idealize. This Rambam we find hard to swallow. We hear about the Goyin who, on his deathbed, wept bitterly, asked why you were crying so much. He said, here he is holding on to a few pieces of string, and became a mitzvah. The other man said, no, mitzvah is not. That's not the kind of content that the Rambam describes. And the drive for more and more and more, for acquiring more, for achieving more, for developing more, that I say, in a sense, it's a Faustian instinct, but we regard it as being a very positive one. And then we find ourselves somewhat torn, really. If everyone was Samech Bechelko, the world would cease to progress. Progress in the world, to some extent, progress in the life of an individual, comes from being not Samech Bechelko. You're an Amoritz, you want to be Talmud Chacham. You're a Kapitzin, you want to be a Gvir. Whatever you do, you want to do better. And whatever you have, you probably want more. And from a social standpoint, having people not be Samech Bechelko is probably beneficial. Of course, for those who argue, this is a famous debate of the 18th century in England, those who argue, as in Mandeville and Fable of the Beast, that, and this later became a central thesis of much of capitalist economic theory, that what are private vices are public virtues. The desire to have more, to do more, to appropriate more, is something which is not morally good for an individual. It should be condemned to having less, more modest as demands, but it's a public virtue in the sense that makes the world go around, that builds society, builds the economy. And that was the assumption of the capitalists. The problem with the capitalists, of course, the two problems. One, that indeed the pie gets bigger and bigger if people are not Samech Bechelko, but the complementary element that eventually the shraim of the pie begin to filter down to the poor classes doesn't always work out that way. And the more critical issue is, indeed, you may very well increase the GNP by encouraging people to be more greedy, and that's what Bechelko. But you'll buy bigger GNP at the expense of a lower moral standard. You have a society of each is a chayim b'loi. That's all everybody wants. Is it worth it? Would that be better to have a community, a society which is content with the lower standard of living, but the one within which is peace and harmony and more concern for the other, more altruism, more idealism? But this whole matter of Rebbe Chelke is a critical issue. It concerns us in a way too. Reb Kamensky is reputed to have said that Samech Bechelko applies even the area of chinuch. You should be content with what you accomplish. But again, it's not being content which pushes you further and further. The sports world, at its best, at its finest, is totally built at Eidus Samech Bechelko. Today you run 200 meters, 22 seconds, you work and work and work, you get it down to 21, you get down to 20. The morality of effort is all built at Eidus Samech Bechelko, and that's sports world at its best, the morality of effort. In the sports world, it's with regard to relatively minor things, that same ethos is applied to the world of learning, the world of Yashamayim. There we would not want to be Bisavir B'chalukim. But yet he says, we've got the Chinuch. Bisavir B'chalukim.
Within the next few weeks, the Motzar Harav series is publishing an English translation of Salvation Zetzal's Mikash Mishan. What background or context is needed when learning Mikash Mishan?
Mikash Mishan is a difficult work to deal with. Depends which parts you're talking about. They are there more so than in Ishalocha, which is in certain respects similar. In Ishalocha too, you have certain sections which are straightforward. I would say Drush, Musav, that's straightforward, which can be read easily. And then there are sections which require some knowledge of Neo-Kantian metaphysics and of modern physics. And your Mikash to be shown is much more of that. It's also less, not as well structured. It's a, in many places, particularly in the last third or so, it's a concatenation of small essays on different topics. But of course, it's much more ambitious than Ishalach is. Ishalach has certain basic thesis which it pushes. It does not strive to encompass the whole range of religious philosophy. Yashim Yisham, to a certain extent, strives to do that, attempts to do that. And that being the case, some knowledge of the philosophic context of the time, crisis theology in Germany, some of the Otto and his followers earlier than that is certainly quite useful. Not for understanding some of the parts. What he has to say about asceticism, including sexual asceticism, is very straightforward, very easily understood. But the other parts, some knowledge of the background is invaluable. There is, I presume you know, some debate amongst certain circles about the extent to which the law was a bit of a lone wolf in this respect, which if you talk about his position within the Torah world, that part of him that went to visit the Chaim Esav so frequently, etc., there indeed is very much a loner. As Masvidov at the time, I said that the question is not who else of comparable stature learning could have written Vasot Machshava, but who else of the people of comparable stature learning could understand them. But then other people who don't see the singularity of having such a double to write these works and integrate them with his learning experience, but to insist on weaving it up into the fabric of contemporary philosophy at the time. In some areas, I imagine it's truer than others, philosophy of science, of which I know very, very little. I imagine that probably more the case. But Svetlana Schweitzer, the Bar Ilan, has written two volumes on the law. He's very insistent. He thinks the Isha Aloch, he has a question mark, because Isha Aloch, Isha Dat, it was the law, make a mid Aloch, that's a good Aloch. It's a nonsense, special nonsense. So I don't know what to tell you in terms of what baggage would be helpful to you. For certain parts, you need some kinds of baggage. For other parts, you need others. But it's not studies your work, some of the points that I mentioned earlier about this being concatenation for smaller essays, I think was due to the fact that some of it was reworked. Rabbi Bekash Misham, which initially was entitled Isha Elohim, and was a twin to Isha Elohim, it was written about a year afterwards, and written with great fervor, with great passion. There were parts of which were written with the Rabbi Step all night writing. His wife would come out and ask, what are you writing? No, yeah, why? Can't I wait until tomorrow? No, he has to write. And it was a great creative outburst and a great emotional outburst. Then it was set aside, I don't know exactly why, and went back to work, to rework it, after his wife was nifta. Couple of years afterwards. Then we worked it to some extent with my brother in law, Professor Tversky. He told me, that's not the Rabbi, but Yitzchak, that there were significant changes. Almost all of the direction of watering it down and making it more readily understandable. And he felt that the changes considered in toto, had diluted the work rather than strengthened it. And I could see that as the Rav's, as he, to his latter years, he was not as tense and not as intense in many respects, and in large respects as well. I would push him a certain, publish certain things, and he would say, no, I'm not a Rav and Trabe, I'm not a Chosin who has to make an impression on a Shirel, that he has to write things which will excite the Torah world. He has to write what people need to hear, and some people need to hear what things are more popular vein. Some of that I think crept into the Kashi Misham as well. If it existed only for the sake of its introductory section, Dayenu, the introductory parts of Kashti Misho on one end and Madodech Midor on the other, from a strict literary point of view, the best things he wrote. And all of that work is gone with that translation that you might know. People went over it, and I was one of them, and my son is one of them, and Mark Steiner worked on it, and Schatz worked, Joel Wawalski, a lot of people worked on it. Yes?
In matters of Torah, Chumash, Mishnah, Gemara, that relate to sexual matters, how should one teach those to school children, and at what point should one not change matters?
My mother, Shalom, was raised in Tells, and she lived Mamish. She was born Mamish in the Hoif of the Tells Yeshiva. So she got to pick up some of the interesting tidbits about them. Told the yeshivas. One of them, she used to quote that someone asked the one of the rabbeim was learning, I don't say Pesach Pasuach, whatever he was learning. And somebody asked one of the rabbis, what are you doing? What are you teaching? He says, all things unzich, fatumul zazet, vashtein gomim zon tutzich. I confuse them so much explaining it, they don't understand what's going on. That is perhaps a more radical example. But the other things people are reluctant to learn about. I remember the first year that I lived Baba Kamba, I was 9 years old at the time. And we learned to go on a Meniach, and we forgot the Mazik Zishvitav Shemitah, so that was skipped. Of course, that was skipped, everyone ran to learn first. See what was there then was being skipped. In Chazal, I'm not sure whether this kind of reluctance or a certain innocence which maybe people lost today. When Mishnah talks about Indershim Raya's Mishnah Giyiv, what is there? The other thing you understand, my Simakov, my Simreshis, why you don't want to be there? Why can't we be Indershim Raya's? Or the Gemara speaks in Subis, the Takuyin Kalchur of Mad Knesses, but Mishnah Nabal Spiv, etc., etc. That reflect their reluctance. Discuss such issues altogether. But you're asking me in the sense that not the principle, but educationally speaking. Maybe today feel that the kind of exposure that even young children, relatively young children, have to such matters, the level of sophistication, which is well beyond what previously had been the case, you know, the children being taught that the stork brought a baby home, and they didn't know how it all transpired. And therefore, there was no point in trying to hide anything, because if they don't pick up, when you learn with them, they'll pick up in the street or somewhere else, and you better well present to them in a straightforward manner. Well, that would apply to children of 5 or 6, I'm not sure, but children of more mature age, I would see no reason for hiding anything. Children are 9 or 10. Some of these questions turn another issue, that is, what a particular person holds, what do you think he holds, with regard to the whole area of sexuality in general. To the extent that there's some recoil, in some sense it's all very much b'dievid, and in an ideal world there will be no sexuality altogether, it's simply one way of perpetuating the human race, etc. So then certainly you will want as far as possible to, maybe tie is too strong a word, but certainly to put these things in a very low burner and try somehow to bluff your way through whatever it is that you're learning. If one does not entertain that point of view, one thinks of it as a healthy and vital aspect of human existence and interpersonal relationships, then the sense that something dirty, something filthy, something which is improper, which you shouldn't expose your children to, would also not exist. If you wouldn't think of it, it's a problem that got the food. I imagine, I don't know the whole history of it, but I imagine it would change the history. I remember the first year that I was in the Rosh Shir, I was 17 at the time, and the Rebbe learned Nida. I went to the store on the east side, so I wanted to buy Mira and Nida. He looked at me as if I asked him that I wanted to buy, I don't know, some pornographic expose. He was shocked, absolutely shocked. And part of that has to do also with the question of how one relates to things that one learns. We have this respect sometimes an ambivalent attitude, which cuts in two directions. On one hand, we feel strongly that what a person learns, Dvar Hashem, it's all Dvar Hashem, which I identify with, should be engaged in some existential discourse of what one is learning, and not just learn materials that go mathematics. On the other hand, there are people who are afraid and withdraw. I mentioned to you now about needed. I'm sure there was a Shoyosh once told me, when he was running the cradle at when I fished earlier, said he wanted to make cotton. So when I made cotton, I thought of it, said I love it. He said, I've seen something to that effect. So that becomes a more general issue over and above what you're talking about particularly.
Last week you mentioned how Rabbi Jeremy Rosen, Zichrono Lebracha, appropriately embodied spirituality within the halachic process. What are the gedarim for one who is interested in connecting to Yahadus through such an approach?
I didn't catch your last question.
What are the gedarim for one who is interested in connecting to Yahadus through such an approach?
I'm not sure they can answer that question. The assumption is that there are gedarim, we have to identify them. Now, the question is, the gedarim you might be talking about, are these gedarim which specifically are endemic to what today is called spirituality, and there are excesses which needed to be avoided, or are you talking about simply some aspects of spirituality or some elements of Hashkofa which are problematic, but not specifically, which are applicable to spirituality, but would also be relevant if you were dealing not with spirituality, but with theoretical metaphysics. To the extent that the word spirituality entails a deification of the self, kind of thing which you have in much of the postmodernist talk. I think that could be a very serious problem. But it's a problem which might be more manifest in spirituality, because there the sense of one's own spiritual power and capacity and ability and status becomes more meaningful. But how you see the balance between yourself and the Ben Shalom, how you confront him, that's much more general issue. I have seen the problem of Shigar, for instance. He has all this postmodernist talk, and I don't see how that can go together with religion of any kind, let alone with the Yadus. But I don't think Rav Rosen was into any of that. But those are the things that I think one needs to bear in mind and be concerned about.
Just want to clarify that Mickey Rosen accidentally said the wrong name.
That's what you
said. I accidentally said the wrong name.
Yes.
I was wondering how long, if one's trying to teach the theology of modern orthodoxy or the principles of modern orthodoxy to students who identify themselves as modern orthodox but don't necessarily have a strong commitment to a Torah lifestyle, how one would go about doing that?
If one has such a constituency, what should one do with them?
What?
If one has such a constituency, what should one do?
Basically.
I don't think it's such a good would be a me'erechod. They can fail to have such a commitment either because they identify more fully either to the right or to the left, which is one kind of resistance or distance. They can fail to have it because they identify with very little. Not because they strongly identify with the right and the left. They are, in general, very pallid, philosophically speaking, religiously speaking. So, merely they don't have any intense commitment to any religious persuasion, any religious lifestyle. These obviously need to be dealt with in different ways. You have to take into account, although many people in the modern Orthodox world don't like to do that, but you have to take into account not only how you construct optimally and ideally, if you were dealing with an ideal Talmud, your orientation, your Ashkofer. Take into account how something you say impact upon the Talmud. Same theoretical construct can be put before one person, and this will deepen his religious commitment. Another person will turn him off. You always have to bear in mind when you're teaching, particularly in areas such as a Shkafer, Makshava, you're communicating. You have to know with whom you're communicating, what will be the impact of the message you're trying to get across. That has to be a concern. What you will infer from that will depend to a great extent on what you think will indeed be the result of one presentation as opposed to another. I'm not telling you to lie, but the degree of emphasis that you give can vary. What you omit, what you include, can vary. And there you have to pay much attention to what the impact is. It's a great responsibility that you have. Good thought.
What about the fact that if these students say, are very committed to the idea that they think that what their outlook on the world is modern Orthodox, it's important to them that they can call that modern Orthodox when that doesn't necessarily fit with elements of modernity or elements of Orthodoxy?
I think you have a dual charge in this respect. One is vis-a-vis a particular Talmud who has the kind of orientation that you describe. And of course, in the modern Orthodox world, given the fact that authority in general does not occupy the same position that occupies the Haredi world, by which I mean not which who is an authority, but even those people in the modern Orthodox population considers to be classed as an authority, they're less committed to him that the Haredim are committed to their authorities, and also part of the modernity which makes the modern Orthodox. The modern world is much more individualistic, much more liberal, much more open, less inclined to count out to authoritative views. So, for the particular individual with whom, to whom you're talking, you may have to be careful, maybe have a graduated approach. If you're just dealing with him or with her one-on-one, you might try gradually to wean them away from certain problematic approaches and to bring them closer to a more authentic, tailored approach. And doing that, recognizing that you can't hit them with all Shulchan Aruch at one time, and that do this gradually. The Rambam recognized that in spiritual when he dealt with educational issues and Teres Tshuva and this with Ikrim, and I think that's legitimate. Again, I think you can lie to them just for the sake of being mekarev with them, but how you present them with the degree of emphasis can be of importance. But in doing that, you sometimes are torn between what is best for a particular Talmud and what is best and what is sometimes crucial from a public standpoint. You might take a more moderate approach in dealing with a particular Talmud, but given that public expression is in many respects to dilute the content and the substance of your own Ashkofer. And what might be good for a particular Talmud would not be good, not what you would want to say from a public platform. attachment situation, the problem is you always are dealing with the two levels. You deal with a particular Talmud and deal with the whole classroom. And if you see something radical enough, it's just the classroom, that'll be heard throughout the school and throughout wherever they go, and they call it the Akiva, whatever, they'll talk about it. So all of that you have to weigh in, balance, and comes back to the question of responsibility. Yes?
In dealing with Balei Tshuva, when they ask one how, you know, can should we take on this mitzvah or that mitzvah, what should we tell them regarding taking on mitzvahs and stopping our avaras on a slow process rather than taking it on at once, even though they may be telling them in a certain way to be avaras?
I don't quite know what to tell you. I understand the issue. I don't have much experience with it directly. But I can reflect upon it as a theoretical issue. It's been said of the previous Babichal Rebbe, the last Babichal Rebbe, that the Babich dealt a lot with Balei Tshuva, that sometimes there were people who wanted to mamish, be misguided, so to speak. They want to say, and the Mamchers, they want the works. And he would tell them, go slow, or try to adopt everything, you'll end up overwhelmed. You have to insinuate yourself into the system, insinuate the system into yourself gradually. I have such broad shoulders. If someone came to me and said he wants to be mekabel certain and change his lifestyle, that would get to some remote chumra, but he wants to adopt certain halachos, might be derisa, might be drabanans, but which are part of a Jewish kitchen, a Jewish home. I don't think I would have it within me to tell them, since I, from my own Olympian vantage point, understand if you take on too much, you'll end up taking too little. So go slow and continue doing certain things which are halakhically problematic, prohibited. But I can understand that if you had the self-confidence that he had, that you might present that kind of attitude. Not having that, and not knowing of a theoretical base for encouraging people to continue doing Yisurim, because well, you perceive where you're going to end up eventually. I would have to work them in gradually, pick maybe certain mitzvahs for emphasis and tell them to start with this. It's maybe a way, just a question of how you formulate, but it makes a big difference. If you tell them you can do certain mitzvahs don't continue certain avayas, that's the mezalzel, I think, gufitel, gufeloch. But if someone comes to you and says, I want to be introduced to Yiddish guy that will start living in Jewish life, what should I start with? Rabbi Tal was once asked this question, and he gave, I think, a wonderful answer. He says that you do for the individuals, the way should be for Klal Yisrael. I'll say that tomorrow the Mekabel certain mitzvahs on the way to Matan Torah. Matan Torah followed upon the Mekabel in fairly short order. So I'll say that tomorrow they got Parah Aduma, Kibud Avraham, Shabbos, because one day Dinim. And he said, what is the import of this particular list? And what does it mean for the Baal Tshuva who's coming to talk to you? He said, Chazalman, take certain things, one, two mitzvahs, with which you identify. turn you on, which energize you spiritually, which bring you closer to the Yahadus, because it's something which it's with which you are, as a popular parlance goes, to mitchaber. There's linkage between you and it. That's the one side. That's kibbutz avim. Shabbos in certain respects, dinim. On the other hand, take one mitzvah, which you don't understand at all. You don't identify with it morally, religiously. You don't understand what it's all about. And inculcate into yourself the awareness that to be religious is to submit. To be a Jew in that race is to submit. And to submit is not only to submit practically, is to submit attitudinally, philosophically. And then you end up with two poles. On the one hand, those elements which attract you to Yahadus, the Yiddishkeit. The other is the awareness that to enter the Yiddishkeit is to accept Oyel Malchus Shemayim. Oyel Malchus Shemayim means precisely that you submit your judgment to that of the Ben Shleilu, to the word of Aloha. He wouldn't tell the butcher mitzvahs to, he said, take a mitzvah which you understand, take a mitzvah you don't understand, then one which you like, then one which you don't like, and work at that. I think it's a wonderful answer. I don't know if, but in terms of applying it, you could readily tell a person what to accept, what not to accept. Again, to Beverly Surim, I don't have that breadth of mind that I would be able to do it. But in principle, what Rambam says that you have to, he says, you take a child and educate him, and gradually put more and more on his shoulders, that's what you have to do in such a case as well. Okay.
I think. Yeah.